Listening test. Part 1. You're going to listen to a recorded material. Before you listen, you have 20 seconds to read instructions carefully, and you will listen to it twice. Ready to start.
Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. It's essential for life. The sun is mostly made of it, and it's present in almost all living things. But on Earth, pure hydrogen is very scarce. Instead, it mainly exists combined with oxygen in the form of water. So how does this abundant element get turned into a fuel that could help save the planet? First, hydrogen needs to be obtained. This is done by splitting molecules.
Hydrogen is an energy carrier. Unlike, let's say, petroleum, which is a primary energy source, you have to make hydrogen from something.
To do this requires an input of energy. You can use methane through a process called steam reforming, or a source of electricity through electrolysis. Once you have some hydrogen, you can either burn it directly or mix it with oxygen in a fuel cell, which is rather like a battery. The reaction in the fuel cell produces electricity and heat, and the only waste is water.
One of the benefits of hydrogen in a hydrogen vehicle, let's say, the only emission that comes out of the tailpipe is pure drinkable water. In contrast, of course, to the internal combustion engine, which puts out loads of nasty chemicals and carcinogens.
This means that as long as the energy used to produce it is sustainable, hydrogen can be a truly green fuel. NASA started using hydrogen fuel cells to generate electricity in its space capsules in the 1960s. Today, it's not just being considered as a rocket fuel in space, but also for planes, trains, and automobiles, as well as the industrial sector.
The most likely early applications are going to be in heavy industry. For example, steel and cement making. These are heavy, heavy greenhouse gas polluters, and they consume lots of energy, a lot of coal in particular, and it's very hard to replace that with electricity, which is probably how most of the decarbonization of the global economy will happen.
This isn't the first time hydrogen has been hailed as a fuel of the future. So why has it never taken off? Until renewables existed at scale, making hydrogen required vast amounts of fossil fuel or nuclear energy, which made hydrogen both more expensive and less efficient than other ways of storing and delivering energy. Until climate change moved up the political agenda, hydrogen simply wasn't worth it.
The existing fossil fuel infrastructure has been in place for decades. It's trillions of dollars of invested legacy equipment, and the companies that built it defend their assets. And so it makes it very difficult for governments to force that legacy equipment to be pushed aside in favor of radically new rival equipment, like hydrogen infrastructure, or for that matter, renewable energy.
The passengers look down to see the east coast of America gliding by beneath them.
There has also been a battle against public perception of hydrogen safety, sparked by the Hindenburg disaster in 1937.
Within seconds, there was a terrific explosion aft, and brilliant orange flames formed the backdrop for a tableau of death.
Hydrogen gas is very flammable and does need to be stored in a specific way. But fears about its safety are overblown.
Now, listen to part one again.
Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. It's essential for life. The sun is mostly made of it, and it's present in almost all living things. But on Earth, pure hydrogen is very scarce. Instead, it mainly exists combined with oxygen in the form of water. So how does this abundant element get turned into a fuel that could help save the planet? First, hydrogen needs to be obtained. This is done by splitting molecules.
Hydrogen is an energy carrier. Unlike, let's say, petroleum, which is a primary energy source, you have to make hydrogen from something.
To do this requires an input of energy. You can use methane through a process called steam reforming, or a source of electricity through electrolysis. Once you have some hydrogen, you can either burn it directly or mix it with oxygen in a fuel cell, which is rather like a battery. The reaction in the fuel cell produces electricity and heat, and the only waste is water.
One of the benefits of hydrogen in a hydrogen vehicle, let's say, the only emission that comes out of the tailpipe is pure drinkable water. In contrast, of course, to the internal combustion engine, which puts out loads of nasty chemicals and carcinogens.
This means that as long as the energy used to produce it is sustainable, hydrogen can be a truly green fuel. NASA started using hydrogen fuel cells to generate electricity in its space capsules in the 1960s. Today, it's not just being considered as a rocket fuel in space, but also for planes, trains, and automobiles, as well as the industrial sector.
The most likely early applications are going to be in heavy industry, for example, steel and cement making. These are heavy, heavy greenhouse gas polluters, and they consume lots of energy, a lot of coal in particular, and it's very hard to replace that with electricity, which is probably how most of the decarbonization of the global economy will happen.
This isn't the first time hydrogen has been hailed as a fuel of the future. So why has it never taken off? Until renewables existed at scale, making hydrogen required vast amounts of fossil fuel or nuclear energy, which made hydrogen both more expensive and less efficient than other ways of storing and delivering energy. Until climate change moved up the political agenda, hydrogen simply wasn't worth it.
The existing fossil fuel infrastructure has been in place for decades. It's trillions of dollars of invested legacy equipment, and the companies that built it defend their assets. And so it makes it very difficult for governments to force that legacy equipment to be pushed aside in favor of radically new rival equipment, like hydrogen infrastructure, or for that matter, renewable energy.
The passengers look down to see the east coast of America gliding by beneath them.
There has also been a battle against public perception of hydrogen safety, sparked by the Hindenburg disaster in 1937.
Within seconds, there was a terrific explosion aft, and brilliant orange flames formed the backdrop for a tableau of death.
Hydrogen gas is very flammable and does need to be stored in a specific way. But fears about its safety are overblown.
Part 2. You're going to listen to another recorded material. Again, before you listen, you have 20 seconds to read the instructions carefully, and you will listen to it twice. You're ready to start.
Good morning, everyone. Last week, we were looking at the hunter-gatherers in Ireland, across the Irish Sea from England. Today, we're going to move on to the period between 4 and 6,000 years ago, known as the Neolithic period, which is when a total farming economy was introduced in Ireland. Let's turn our attention now to the farming technology available at that time. Before the cereal crops could be planted, it would have been necessary to clear the forest and to break the ground by ploughing. The stone blade of a plough has been discovered during excavation in County Mayo in Western Ireland. The body of the plough would have been of wood and could have been drawn by people, but it's also likely that cattle were used. Now, the cultivation of crops and the husbandry of livestock brought about changes in people's lifestyle, such as the type of shelters they made. For one thing, instead of moving from place to place, they needed permanent dwellings. The stone axes used to chop down trees to make these dwellings were far superior to any that the Stone Age hunter-gatherers used. To make the axes, sources of suitable stone had to be found and systematically exploited. These so-called axe factories were really quarries rather than factories, as the manufacture of the axes wasn't regularly performed on the quarry site. However, after the axe had been chipped into shape, they needed water and sand for grinding and polishing, so a high mountainside wouldn't have been an appropriate place for this. So this final stage of the manufacture must have been carried out close to water. And sure enough, there's ample evidence of this at coastal sites. Now, it's clear that these Neolithic axes were transported all over Ireland, as well as to Scotland and the south of England. It's not really surprising that axes from axe factories in England have also been found in Ireland. At the very least, this indicates that there was a link between the two islands during that period. One of the most useful innovations of the colonisers was pottery making, which was quite unknown to Irish hunter-gatherers. The pottery was probably made by shaping clay into a ball with the hand, and then hollowing it until the walls were the right thickness. After firing, the outside was often polished. This would have helped the pots to retain water, as they weren't glazed. Now, we know that the clay used usually came from local sources, which suggests that manufacture was on a fairly small scale, even though thousands of fragments are usually found at Neolithic sites. In the course of time, decoration began to appear. At first, this looked like a series of stitches and was just around the tops of the pots. This could have been an imitation of earlier vessels, which were made of leather sewn onto wood. Then, eventually, pots with decoration all over became much more...
Now you'll hear the recording again.
Good morning, everyone. Last week, we were looking at the hunter-gatherers in Ireland, across the Irish Sea from England. Today, we're going to move on to the period between 4 and 6,000 years ago, known as the Neolithic period, which is when a total farming economy was introduced in Ireland. Let's turn our attention now to the farming technology available at that time. Before the cereal crops could be planted, it would have been necessary to clear the forest and to break the ground by ploughing. The stone blade of a plough has been discovered during excavation in County Mayo in Western Ireland. The body of the plough would have been of wood and could have been drawn by people, but it's also likely that cattle were used. Now, the cultivation of crops and the husbandry of livestock brought about changes in people's lifestyle, such as the type of shelters they made. For one thing, instead of moving from place to place, they needed permanent dwellings. The stone axes used to chop down trees to make these dwellings were far superior to any that the Stone Age hunter-gatherers used. To make the axes, sources of suitable stone had to be found and systematically exploited. These so-called axe factories were really quarries rather than factories, as the manufacture of the axes wasn't regularly performed on the quarry site. However, after the axe had been chipped into shape, they needed water and sand for grinding and polishing, so a high mountainside wouldn't have been an appropriate place for this. So this final stage of the manufacture must have been carried out close to water, and sure enough, there's ample evidence of this at coastal sites. Now, it's clear that these Neolithic axes were transported all over Ireland, as well as to Scotland and the south of England. It's not really surprising that axes from axe factories in England have also been found in Ireland. At the very least, this indicates that there was a link between the two islands during that period. One of the most useful innovations of the colonisers was pottery making, which was quite unknown to Irish hunter-gatherers. The pottery was probably made by shaping clay into a ball with the hand, and then hollowing it until the walls were the right thickness. After firing, the outside was often polished. This would have helped the pots to retain water, as they weren't glazed. Now, we know that the clay used usually came from local sources, which suggests that manufacture was on a fairly small scale, even though thousands of fragments are usually found at Neolithic sites. In the course of time, decoration began to appear. At first, this looked like a series of stitches and was just around the tops of the pots. This could have been an imitation of earlier vessels, which were made of leather sewn onto wood. Then, eventually, pots with decoration all over became much more...
Part 3. You also have 20 seconds to read the instructions before you listen. And you will also listen to it twice. You're ready to start.
This course is proving to be much more interesting than I imagined it would be, Gareth.
Yes, it really makes you sit up and think because there's so much more to it than just architecture.
from the first day I was engrossed in it. Do you remember at the beginning we were asked to model a city that would accommodate 1 million people? We were told to work out what infrastructure, housing and shopping facilities we'd include. And then keep that original model on our laptop. That was fun. But changing it as we're going through the course and making improvements has been even more enjoyable. We've saved every version so we can see how it's changed as we've learned something new.
Yes, you can easily see what you under- or overestimated would be needed. And it's amazing to think that the main idea of our city is to build up as high as possible. I didn't really consider so many skyscrapers. But it's obviously the way of the future with so many people moving to cities now.
It never entered my head that skyscrapers could be connected by sky bridges and corridors, served by elevated transport systems. And what about high-rise parks and gardens? Oh, fantastic ideas.
And let's not forget going underground. I was surprised to learn that we'll have to make more use of the space beneath our feet. Showing us the example of Singapore, where there are already shopping centres with floors that go down several stories below street level, was a real eye-opener.
All the modules on this course have captured everyone's attention. I did History of Architecture and Design at school, and this course encompasses these and more.
Yes, and other topics such as architects having to take into account economy of scale and how they achieve it, for example, by using low-energy innovations.
Those ideas particularly drew my attention. I love the notion of using ice batteries. Whoever thought up the idea of using cheap electricity at night to freeze water in the basement and then let it melt during the day to cool the air in the building was extremely imaginative.
That building, what was it called? Ah, yes, the Bank of America Tower, apart from the ice batteries, was built mainly from recycled material. It also stores rainwater to recycle and conserves water using other means. I'm looking forward to going to New York to see it, though I suppose by the time we get there it will have been superseded by another building that's taller and even more innovative.
True. And don't you think money must play a huge part? You can't just spend a fortune designing a building to suit your own ideals. After all, the owner will want to sell or rent the flats, retail space or whatever, and make a profit. Therefore, there must be a budget which would impose some limitations.
Absolutely. So, have you decided what your project will be about? I bet it's going to be along the lines of how people will move around, as well as live and relax in their ivory towers in the sky.
How did you guess? Oh, joking aside, I'm considering focusing on how to improve escape routes in the event of some sort of disaster, coupled with designing something that can house thousands of people, but is constructed so that no one feels overcrowded or cramped.
Sounds good. I'm going to concentrate on solar power, not just from the point of optimizing solar energy for heating, more from the penetration of the sun into the building so that everyone gets enough light in their home. Also, so the sun is not blocked out in the gardens, walkways or parks that you mentioned earlier. Taller buildings also shouldn't block out the sun on other shorter buildings.
Good luck with it.
Now you will hear part three again.
This course is proving to be much more interesting than I imagined it would be, Gareth.
Yes, it really makes you sit up and think because there's so much more to it than just architecture.
From the first day I was engrossed in it, do you remember at the beginning we were asked to model a city that would accommodate 1 million people? We were told to work out what infrastructure, housing and shopping facilities we'd include. And then keep that original model on our laptop. That was fun, but changing it as we're going through the course and making improvements has been even more enjoyable. We've saved every version so we can see how it's changed as we've learned something new.
Yes, you can easily see what you under- or overestimated would be needed. And it's amazing to think that the main idea of our city is to build up as high as possible. I didn't really consider so many skyscrapers, but it's obviously the way of the future with so many people moving to cities now.
It never entered my head that skyscrapers could be connected by sky bridges and corridors served by elevated transport systems. And what about high-rise parks and gardens? Oh, fantastic ideas.
And let's not forget going underground. I was surprised to learn that we'll have to make more use of the space beneath our feet. Showing us the example of Singapore, where there are already shopping centres with floors that go down several stories below street level, was a real eye-opener.
All the modules on this course have captured everyone's attention. I did History of Architecture and Design at school, and this course encompasses these and more.
Yes, and other topics such as architects having to take into account economy of scale and how they achieve it, for example, by using low-energy innovations.
Those ideas particularly drew my attention. I love the notion of using ice batteries. Whoever thought up the idea of using cheap electricity at night to freeze water in the basement and then let it melt during the day to cool the air in the building was extremely imaginative.
That building, what was it called? Ah, yes, the Bank of America Tower, apart from the ice batteries, was built mainly from recycled material. It also stores rainwater to recycle and conserves water using other means. I'm looking forward to going to New York to see it, though I suppose by the time we get there it will have been superseded by another building that's taller and even more innovative.
True. And don't you think money must play a huge part? You can't just spend a fortune designing a building to suit your own ideals. After all, the owner will want to sell or rent the flats, retail space or whatever, and make a profit. Therefore, there must be a budget which would impose some limitations.
Absolutely. So, have you decided what your project will be about? I bet it's going to be along the lines of how people will move around, as well as live and relax in their ivory towers in the sky.
How did you guess? Joking aside, I'm considering focusing on how to improve escape routes in the event of some sort of disaster, coupled with designing something that can house thousands of people, but is constructed so that no one feels overcrowded or cramped.
Sounds good. I'm going to concentrate on solar power, not just from the point of optimising solar energy for heating, more from the penetration of the sun into the building so that everyone gets enough light in their home. Also, so the sun is not blocked out in the gardens, walkways or parks that you mentioned earlier. Taller buildings also shouldn't block out the sun on other shorter buildings.
Good luck with it.
That is the end of part three.
Part 4. You're going to listen to the final recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
The secretary bird is one of the most gorgeous and widespread birds in all of sub-Saharan Africa. They can be found strutting around in open grasslands and savannas across the continent.
Despite their stork-like physique, their closest relatives are birds of prey, like eagles and hawks. And like birds of prey, they have a special ability. They can squirt their feces instead of dropping it.
Wonderful. Secretary birds are basically eagles on stilts and can be up to 1.3 meters tall, which is almost as tall as I am, which, for a human, isn't very tall.
Surprisingly, these tall birds are incredibly light, at just about 4 kilograms. Their hollow bones help them get very tall and statuesque without making them too heavy for flight. They can fly at heights of up to 3,000 meters, but they're not quite as graceful as their aquiline cousins. But when you look this fly on land, there's little reason to leave the ground.
These killer queens have been turning heads for thousands of years.
Even the ancient Egyptians admired them. Bas-reliefs depicting secretary birds were recently discovered at the Temple of Hatshepsut. The amazing thing is that there are no secretary birds in Egypt. The artists were so awestruck by their beauty that they carved the beautiful birds in stone for posterity.
European naturalists were also struck by their elegance.
They were originally named Sagittarius, which is Greek for archer, because of their refined and deliberate gait, as well as for their head feathers, which resemble the arrows sticking out of an archer's quiver. Nobody knows for sure how the name changed from Sagittarius to the less impressive secretary bird. The leading theory is that they reminded English naturalists of their secretaries, who used to use goose quill pens and put them in their hair when they were not writing.
The other theory is that it comes from the Arabic word sakaret air, which means hunter bird, but please forgive my pronunciation, I can't pretend that I know how to do that correctly.
And that might be a more accurate name. Everything about their biology is designed for hunting dangerous prey, particularly venomous snakes. They have legs for days, but they're stomping machines that kick with deadly accuracy. When they find a snake, secretary birds go for the head and stomp with ferocious speed.
Their stomps can produce forces of 20 kilograms. That's 5 times greater than their body weight.
Their fashion-forward plumage serves as a distraction. When hunting, they shake their tail feathers and wings to get the snake's attention away from their legs to prevent them from biting them.
Some reports even suggest that they're at least partially immune to snake venom.
As a secondary safety measure, their contact time with the snake is just about 15 milliseconds. That's faster than the blink of an eye, and more importantly, faster than a snake's reaction time. Just call them Foot of the North Star.
Blink and you'll miss it.
Their beautiful eyes have luscious eyelashes. These are modified feathers that filter debris when they're stomping and kicking up dust.
Maybe it's an evolutionary trait developed over hundreds of thousands of years to protect their most important sensory organ. Or maybe it's Maybelline.
In any case, they have the prettiest peepers in the animal kingdom. With these extravagant looks, you would expect them to be avian Casanovas, but they're really more like Romeos and Juliets. During courtship, males perform an elaborate flight display. If a female likes them, they'll form a monogamous couple and will build a large nest on an acacia tree. The nests are about 2.5 meters wide, spacious enough for the two secretary birds and a couple of babies.
To feed their babies, secretary birds carry food in their mouths rather than with their talons.
Their legs are deadly stomping machines, and their talons are sharp enough to shred prey to pieces, but their feet are not strong enough to carry heavy prey. Unfortunately, even though they can lay up to 4 eggs, usually only 2 babies survive. They have to compete with each other for the food that their parents bring home. The youngest one usually starves to death. This fratricidal conflict is also known as Cainism.
Parental care doesn't end at the nest.
After 80 days, the babies fledge and leave the nest, but the parents stick around until the young learn how to hunt for themselves. Once they're fully grown and pretty, they'll disperse and start their own beautiful families.
Now listen to part 4 again.
The secretary bird is one of the most gorgeous and widespread birds in all of sub-Saharan Africa. They can be found strutting around in open grasslands and savannas across the continent.
Despite their stork-like physique, their closest relatives are birds of prey, like eagles and hawks. And like birds of prey, they have a special ability. They can squirt their feces instead of dropping it.
Wonderful. Secretary birds are basically eagles on stilts and can be up to 1.3 meters tall, which is almost as tall as I am, which for a human isn't very tall.
Surprisingly, these tall birds are incredibly light at just about 4 kilograms. Their hollow bones help them get very tall and statuesque without making them too heavy for flight. They can fly at heights of up to 3,000 meters, but they're not quite as graceful as their aquiline cousins. But when you look this fly on land, there's little reason to leave the ground.
These killer queens have been turning heads for thousands of years.
Even the ancient Egyptians admired them. Bas-reliefs depicting secretary birds were recently discovered at the Temple of Hatshepsut. The amazing thing is that there are no secretary birds in Egypt. The artists were so awestruck by their beauty that they carved the beautiful birds in stone for posterity.
European naturalists were also struck by their elegance.
They were originally named Sagittarius, which is Greek for archer, because of their refined and deliberate gait. as well as for their head feathers, which resemble the arrow sticking out of an archer's quiver. Nobody knows for sure how the name changed from Sagittarius to the less impressive secretary bird. The leading theory is that they reminded English naturalists of their secretaries, who used to use goose quill pens and put them in their hair when they were not writing. The other theory is that it comes from the Arabic word sakaret air, which means hunter bird. But please forgive my pronunciation, I can't pretend that I know how to do that correctly. And that might be a more accurate name. Everything about their biology is designed for hunting dangerous prey, particularly venomous snakes. They have legs for days, but they're stomping machines that kick with deadly accuracy. When they find a snake, secretary birds go for the head and stomp with ferocious speed. Their stomps can produce forces of 20 kilograms. That's 5 times greater than their body weight. Their fashion-forward plumage serves as a distraction. When hunting, they shake their tail feathers and wings to get the snake's attention away from their legs to prevent them from biting them. Some reports even suggest that they're at least partially immune to snake venom. As a secondary safety measure, their contact time with the snake is just about 15 milliseconds. That's faster than the blink of an eye, and more importantly, faster than a snake's reaction time. Just call them Foot of the North Star. Blink and you'll miss it. Their beautiful eyes have luscious eyelashes. These are modified feathers that filter debris when they're stomping and kicking up dust. Maybe it's an evolutionary trait developed over hundreds of thousands of years to protect their most important sensory organ. Or maybe it's Maybelline. In any case, they have the prettiest peepers in the animal kingdom. With these extravagant looks, you would expect them to be avian Casanovas, but they're really more like Romeos and Juliets. During courtship, males perform an elaborate flight display. If a female likes them, they'll form a monogamous couple and will build a large nest on an acacia tree. The nests are about 2.5 meters wide, spacious enough for the two secretary birds and a couple of babies. To feed their babies, secretary birds carry food in their mouths rather than with their talons. Their legs are deadly stomping machines, and their talons are sharp enough to shred prey to pieces, but their feet are not strong enough to carry heavy prey. Unfortunately, even though they can lay up to 4 eggs, usually only 2 babies survive. They have to compete with each other for the food that their parents bring home. The youngest one usually starves to death. This fratricidal conflict is also known as Cainism. Parental care doesn't end at the nest. After 80 days, the babies fledge and leave the nest, but the parents stick around until the young learn how to hunt for themselves. Once they're fully grown and pretty, they'll disperse and start their own beautiful families.
That's the end of the listening section. You now have 2 minutes to check all your answers.